The echo chamber, reflections on an extended conversation. Earlier this year, I caught up with some dear friends I hadn't seen in decades. They were an important part of my church and home group many years ago, and it was lovely to catch up with them and reminisce and hear about our life journeys since we parted. Is that recording? Excellent. There's a particular person I really want to hear this, who's not here at the moment. Yeah, it was lovely to hear our life journeys, but as the night went on, it became apparent that at least one of us wasn't quite the same person who left our shores all those years ago. To understand this, I need to say something about our church at the time. Henderson Memorial was a pain in the ass for the Presbyterian State Assembly. We were a thorn in the side. Thanks, Alyssa. Of a male-dominated and conservative leadership. Under Graham Chipps' teaching, women shared in leadership. We attracted young people from all over Perth, keen to hear about God's option for the poor, about social justice, about the here now but not yet of the kingdom of God. And with the exception of the older members who graciously put up with us, you could have predicted to a person how we voted. We chose parties whose policies most aligned with our values. I remember one Sunday, after what must have been a very long and impassioned prayer, Graham came up to me and said, "Paul, that sounded like a political broadcast for the Labor Party." Fair call. I haven't really changed in my outlook. I still see leftist parties as best aligning with Jesus' teaching, and I suspect I'm not alone here today. So forward to January this year, and I'm sipping Chardonnay with my friend Scott. That's a loaded phrase. Catching up on 20 years of births, deaths and marriages. And I'm hearing little pushbacks on a whole range of different fronts. At first I thought I just wasn't hearing him correctly, but the more I probed, the more it became apparent that we weren't on the same page anymore. A few days later at the pub, we'd both had a few Kilkennys, and we were enjoying that lovely glow you get when you've lost count, whether it was one or two or whatever. Scott was clearly the person I remembered and loved from his time here in Perth. We picked up where we left off, and we shared joys, and we shared some sorrows, and about how it felt to be a stranger in a strange world. But it was also clear that his worldview had undergone some kind of dramatic shift that I can only describe as going from left wing to some other wing that I couldn't quite describe. What could have possibly happened that so shifted his worldview to one that I had major problems with? There wasn't enough time to explore this further, and by then the Kilkenny had completely taken over my rational thought processes. But Scott's journey had intrigued me, and I wasn't willing to leave it. So we started a conversation that we've been continuing all year over the course of that year, email after email, thread after thread. The answer that Scott eventually gave wasn't what I expected. There was no one cataclysmic event, rather a series of vignettes that gradually challenged his truths, his received truths about politics and social organisation. And as Scott shared with me, so I've had challenged some of my fundamental assumptions and prejudices that I was only barely aware of. One of the first things that I learnt was that chatting with a philosopher is not like other conversations. Philosophers take no prisoners. Words are important. Behind each word lies a meaning. In my case, I assumed that that meaning was shared, and I was wrong. With deftness and gentleness, Scott left me feeling many times like Jon Snow, "I know nothing." It was during the Gore Bush Florida recount in the presidential election of 2000 that Scott seriously questioned the information and analyses that he was getting from media outlets. He said, "I couldn't find a journalist who even knew the right questions to ask. Their cluelessness about USA politics was staggering." So you'd think with a bold statement like that, at this early point in our conversation, I'd have immediately gone into asking some open questions like, tell me more. But no, I was on the front foot, rabbiting on about ABC bias and how that was all bollocks. Looking back, I don't think I ever actually considered the question of whether the ABC was stacked with left-leaning journalists. Perhaps because I liked it that way. In fact, I was convinced that visiting conservative or right-wing sites in the name of balance was unlikely to change my mind. The arrogance. Scott had every right to jump on me, but he didn't. Fortunately, he persisted, and what gradually unfolded was his questioning of the way stories are recounted through the press and how bias is the major issue that prevents us from coming to informed understanding. Our echo chamber, our choice of who we listen to, dramatically affects how we make sense of things. So we fell into a rhythm. I tried asking shorter, open-ended questions. I actually tried to understand his answer rather than springing to my soapbox. And we covered a lot of ground: climate, the oil crisis, poverty, free speech, big government. In many cases, the knowledge to really understand and respond to these big issues is inadequate, and therefore predictions can be way off. Scott reminded me, remember the peak oil scare? Does anyone remember the peak oil scare that came and went? Probably the single most contentious topic we've discussed is climate change. Scott views much of the debate as groupthink. Oh, and now that I remember, that was a spectacular kids' talk. You stole all my thunder. You covered groupthink, you covered protest vote, you covered the whole gamut. There was even Lord of the Flies there. So thank you. That was just brilliant. Scott views that much of the debate is groupthink. Research funding that's granted to projects that support the in-thinking while neglecting the out-thinking that challenges assumptions or model reliability or ecosystem resilience or the precautionary principle. I've really struggled with this. Really struggled. I just don't buy it. I've worked in a science-based organisation for 4 decades, and knowing the scientists and the publication process, I just find it inconceivable that they would avoid the hard questions or be biased by career opportunities, which is what the grant funding thing is all about, either deliberately or subconsciously. Nevertheless, Scott believes there is a subtle but demonstrable bias in which research is granted and funded and therefore which research is conducted. This is a tough issue. There's a lot at stake. If those who believe there is evidence to support anthropogenic climate change are right, our children will inherit a different Earth to the one that we've enjoyed, and we then did nothing about it to stop it. On the other hand, if the models are inaccurate and the Earth happily rolls along with the punches, we could be imposing a whole lot of unnecessary change and anxiety, and in the so doing, diminishing the credibility of the science that we use to inform our decision making. So the need for a civil, sustained conversation is absolutely essential so that we can make the right decisions. But I'm sure you will agree the current conversation is anything but civil. Climate advocates, those who believe that it is anthropogenically forced, routinely dismiss those who don't accept that as idiots. They've become tired and impatient of explaining again and again what is clearly self-evident. In fact, they use the term denialist. My friends use this often. It's such a loaded word because it has belief overtones. You either believe in climate change or you don't. So you're framing it in terms of belief, and therefore dismissing the possibility that people who don't believe that it's anthropogenically forced have arrived at that position through consideration of the evidence. You can visit websites like the Climate Council or the Climate Skeptics, which, when I've looked at them for a second and a third time really are no more than talking points for winning arguments, not for having conversations. On the other hand, there are no shortage of anti-science trolls and unfortunately Christian evangelicals who dismiss the science, absolutely convinced that there is a global conspiracy, that climate change is a big con and an affront to God. Knowing how disorganised and competitive scientists are, I find the notion of a global conspiracy completely laughable. But it's worse than that. As Scott went banging on backwards and forwards, it became clear to me that I lacked the skills to clearly evaluate the science. Most of us lack the skills to evaluate the science. It's complex, it's technical, it's systems theory. We have no choice but to rely on experts. But which experts? Who do you trust? Do you trust the scientists funded by renewable energy foundations or the ones by oil companies? And does the fact that they are funded by oil companies necessarily mean that their research is wrong? That took me back to realise that that wasn't necessarily the case. So we went back and forth. Every argument I put that climate change was real and caused by us came back with a rebuttal, something along the lines of, yeah, but we don't actually know what will happen. We don't really know the extremities of the change and we don't really know the resilience of ecosystems. And that's true. So at some point, I became exhausted with this conversation. Not by the conversation so much, but by the existential dilemma that it presented. How are we meant to live and act in the face of inadequate or equivocal knowledge? Reacting just for the sake of doing something, which is what I tend to do and a lot of my lefty buddies do, can do more damage than good. There is a very high cost to the precautionary principle. So this was a bit of a turning point for me. I was no longer sure about whether I was right and Scott was wrong. And I remember saying that and not so much giving up but saying, Scott, this isn't working for me. I don't know what the hell I'm talking about anymore. And Scott replied back saying, Paul, I'm speechless. No one's ever got this far in a conversation with me. Yeah, where was up to? It's no longer about whether I was right and he was wrong or vice versa. It's about acting responsibly and appropriately in the face of inadequate knowledge. And that's what our conversation turned to. And Scott calls it the knowledge problem. And that is that we rarely have or we underestimate the amount of knowledge that we need to address problems. Even if that knowledge exists, there's no one person who knows it all. And what's more, local circumstances can often confound how knowledge is applied. The idea that you can design a solution to every problem by throwing more money at it flies in the face of experience. But isn't that our typical experience? And you can hit here. Now, I'm shifting now, moving gradually away from just this topic of climate change into how, as a society, we organise ourselves and deal with problems. So isn't that our typical response? Policy designed from afar that often wastes millions of dollars all because we have to do something. The expectations society places on politicians, that politicians place on public servants, creating more and more regulations that either don't work or make things worse. Think about the government intervention in response to sexual abuse within northern Aboriginal communities. How well did that work? Wait a minute. What have we just been talking about? Unnecessary regulation? The size of government? Hang on. Aren't these the things that right-wingers bang on about? Logical, rational arguments for challenging the size and function of government. Well, who'd have thought? I'm not saying there is no role for government. Certainly Scott wasn't saying that. But what he's left me pondering is that we might be looking at the wrong place to solve our problems. as life becomes more complex and uncertain, expecting governments to manage complexity and provide certainty is wishful thinking. Lefties do have a tendency to place more and more responsibility on the collective at the expense of the individual. What this conversation with Scott has given me the opportunity to do is to think outside my tribe, to evaluate whether this is always the best strategy. I've always thought it was, and now I'm not sure that's true anymore. So Scott and I covered a huge amount of ground. The marketplace, collectivism versus individualism, government safety nets, wealth accumulation, taxation, government versus private education, oh, that was a hot one. Public versus private health insurance, that was even hotter. And gun control in the US, with someone who was actually born in the US and raised in the US. Looking back, I'm staggered at how much ground we covered. We've had much more in common than I expected. Despite the contentious issues, we've been able to discuss without rancour or name-calling, with civility and patience, even when parochial blinkers or cultural assumptions were at play, which is pretty well with me. We've remarked on more than one occasion how rare this kind of conversation is. It just doesn't happen. Why is that? Why are there so few sustained conversations between those who believe collectivism is the best strategy and those who advocate for individualism? Where are the sensible people to point out that it's not either or, but both and? And extending that to my faith community, where are the sustained discussions between those who see the Bible as holy writ and those who see Jesus as the Word and the Bible as a compilation of human experience? In fact, those conversations have been happening. It's been fantastic. Here are some suggestions as why I don't think those conversations happen very often. Surrounding myself with my tribe is just easier. It validates my worldview. It's exhausting to be challenged on a belief or a view that I gain value or joy from. Unfortunately, this leads to groupthink, and it was lovely to see how the groupthink happened with the kids, where a whole bunch of kids moved that way and then a whole bunch coattailed along with them. I don't think they'd thought through the issues very much. Or dismissing ideas purely by association with a particular wing, be it left or right, fundamentalist or liberal. If I'm brutally honest, I have treated in the past views and ideas outside my tribe as deficient in some way. I haven't always considered that there might be someone as clever as me who just happened to land in a different place. Thirdly, we've lost the capacity to discuss issues civilly and are therefore afraid to have the discussion at all. Public conversation on Facebook is just fraught. There are too many of my friends who are hotheads. I can only have private conversations now. Friendship is far more important to me than agreement on social or political issues. And even then, the conversation quickly peters out. It's really interesting. So hopefully by now you've got my point that while tribes are safe places for us to be, in the long run they can give a warped view of the world, because your tribe is determined by politics, whether your tribe is determined by politics, religion or whatever. Closed tribes, in other words, ones where all the conversations we have are just within our little group, become echo chambers where the same ideas get bounced around and around, reinforcing or amplifying their strength to the point where we wind up congratulating ourselves. The fact is, our tribe is a choice that we've made based on our knowledge and experience. No one person or tribe has all the knowledge or all the experience. We can debate whose tribe is best till the cows come home. It's all good. So I'm not saying it's wrong to have tribes. I'm just saying no one tribe has all the answers. There's one awkwardness or exception that I want to make, particularly in the context of politically based tribes, and it's worth spending a little bit of time here so that the conversations that we develop are more productive. At the extreme end of what we call right-wing in this country is a group of views centred around race and intolerance of minorities. They come under the name of alt-right or extreme right, views that many of us would find repugnant. Alt-right at the moment is a bit of a global phenomenon, but really it's been there forever. There's just more permission for people to say what they've always thought. This may be a bit controversial, and I'm sorry for those people who do get offended, but for me, right-wing politics is often tainted with a faint whiff of racism and intolerance in a way that the left is not. Now, I'm really open to be challenged on that, and Scott, if you're listening, I'm ready for the emails. But this garret smells to high heaven with racism and intolerance, which is really unfortunate, because right-wing does not and should not mean an instinctive or a subtle link with racism. I'm sure that the Liberal and the National Party voters in this church would be highly offended at the idea that they were racist or intolerant of minorities. Left-wingers need to get off their self-righteous high horse. They don't have a monopoly on the high ground. And don't forget that lots of Labor Party voters drifted to One Nation. Why alt-right ideas have nestled in with conservative politics is a conversation in its own right. But it's important that we tease those things apart so that we don't pigeonhole people. So on the assumption that right-wing is a whole collection of ideas that are valid to discuss in their own right, just like left-wing ideas are, I want to treat racism and intolerance as a separate thing, and we do need to discuss it. Because if we frame our debate with people who are outside our tribe in terms of racism, that debate is often simplistic and unhelpful. Firstly, by calling somebody racist when they don't see themselves as racist, just backs them into a defensive corner. You're not actually achieving anything. Secondly, the place where racism comes from is nuanced. White males in Western industrialised countries, that's where a lot of the alt-right energy comes from at the moment, have been displaced from their jobs over the last 20, 30, 40 years, from improvements in automation of industry and technology, as much as from competition with cheap overseas labour. You know that there are car factories in Michigan, in the States, in Elizabeth and South Australia that lie dead and disused. The companies invariably survive, they always survive, while the workers lose out. Who's to blame? Well, it's so much easier to blame those outside of our tribe, refugees, Muslims, foreigners. That blame has been aided and abetted by successive governments, mostly conservative, but not always, who regularly blow opportunistic dog whistles to capitalise on fear and uncertainty for the sake of power. So perhaps the more nuanced interpretation of racism is that it's an expression of at least two really powerful emotions, grief and fear. Grief over the loss of once held power while still feeling entitled to that power, and fear of where it will all end. This is not just true for angry white males, but it's true for white Christians as well. I think you can explain a lot of the argument from Corey Bernardi in terms of grief, about the loss and the loss of that sense of entitlement of power. The fact is that Christians have to share their space with other minorities. Christians are a minority in this country, and they shouldn't miss the irony of trying to keep their dominant place in society when they are a minority themselves. By all means, advocate for the world we want, but if we don't want democracy to descend to mob rule that's intolerant of minorities, we have to let go of our sense of entitlement. So I'm suggesting that if we can see and look at racism as expressions of underlying emotions of grief and fear, perhaps we'll come up with a better and more productive and more healthy conversation rather than just resorting to name-calling and demonisation. So what does that all mean for us here at Mount Hawthorne and our little fellowship here? How do we deal with the effects of the echo chamber? How do we cultivate civil conversations that last long enough to get to the real issues? I suggest the following. And just quote Scott, we need to get out more. How often do we go to other churches? How often do we strike up conversations with people we disagree with? Do we actually know anyone we disagree with? What media do we subscribe to? What papers do we read? What friends do we filter out on Facebook? Sorry, mea culpa. When we do strike up those conversations, what do they look like? Do we try to hear the fear, the grief, the loneliness, the genuine grievance at social inequity? That applies as much to religion as to politics. Just repeating myself there. We need to recognise that within our own fellowship, there are several tribes, including right-wingers, Liberal Party voters, National Party voters, Liberals, Evangelicals and fundies. These are part of our community. We love them dearly. We should be respectful in our language of all of the tribes that people have landed in. After all, we might be wrong. If we do need to call out ideas, address the idea and not the person. Make sure our criticisms aren't just knee-jerk name-calling. Make sure we avoid typecasting particular countries or races. It is not cool to bag Americans. That's their job. And here's the thing. It's actually possible to do all of this while still being true to ourselves. Yes, listening to those we disagree with is hard, because authentic listening means hearing what they're actually saying and not just preparing a response. That means letting go of our guard and inviting the possibility that we might be wrong or that we might learn something. If those views don't line up with our moral or ethical framework, we have every right to call those views out in love. If we believe those views will bring danger or harm to the earth or its people, we should advocate strongly against those views. That's what democracy is about. It's not about the largest mob ruling over all the other mobs. It's about letting all the mobs live together without killing each other. If we stay hidden in our tribes, we will never develop the relationships that we need to have honest conversations. It's only through honest and safe conversations that people will be in a place to face reality and make hard decisions. And to feel safe to do that. Let me encourage all of us to step out from our safe tribes and get to know those on the other side. I believe that's what Jesus did. And that's my talk.
Thank you. Just want to take issue with a point, and I'll try and play the ball and not the man. To compare peak oil as a scare, to say that peak oil might be a scare and then compare it to what we have learnt about climate change, I think is unfortunate. Part of why some people think peak oil is a scare could possibly be because so much preparation was made, and also we are there. Why else are we have so many communities protesting against fracking, companies wanting to dig under the Alaskan wilderness, and what's more, big petroleum companies like BP, who are some of the biggest researchers and developers and retailers of solar power. Mostly because we're living in a post-peak oil world. All the easy-to-get-at, good-quality oil is pretty much used up. So that's that. To then look at climate change as perhaps something that's very modern is not... It's just a different way of describing something that's possibly always been there, in that it used to be called thrift, we now call it sustainability. It used to be called anti-pollution, we now call it environmental awareness or what have you. I believe that all the things that we would do to combat the things we think we know about climate change will make a better world, not a worse world. So if it does turn out we're wrong, our kids won't be so hard on us as if we didn't do it at all. And it's not that we haven't been doing it, because since Rachel Carson wrote her book, all of us have been doing something. I think that's all.
I would agree with all of that. Yep.
That it's okay if you don't, but I just I think that was all
but
I had
I
to
do.
Say.
I don't agree. I don't agree with the statement, all of us have been doing something. I think there are segments of the community that have very different views of the people's role in the world, and we are at great risk if we think that everyone thinks the same way we do. We actually need to stop and think there are people who didn't agree with Carson, who don't agree with environmental regulation, and who want unfettered access and control.
Don't forget, the point I was making was not to debate climate change. It was about how to have the conversation.
Well, I've got the mic.
Yeah.
Firstly, Paul, this is why no one will go have a beer with you anymore. I take that back for the recording. Just listening, the idea of grief and loss being behind a lot of reaction and anger and fear. It's interesting in my role, especially being supported by a range of churches and church communities, the whole idea of sexual identity and ideology and all that, that's for churches, that's going to be a huge, well, it is a huge line in the sand. And it's interesting in my role and in the school where I've been asked to support certain students, even with families that don't accept what's going on. It's just interesting that there's an irony where I'm from a community that on one hand is accepting and one hand isn't, and it's a huge line in the sand. And looking at left and looking at right and hearing fear and loss on both sides. Mm. And I was talking to someone this week about the idea of ambivalent loss, where it's a complex loss.
Yeah.
So that hearing what the church and what faith communities are talking about, where they think it's still a binary world, et cetera, et cetera, it's a real... You have to sit and listen to people's sense of loss, and it's complex and it's deep and it's... There's no easy answer.
That brings to mind one of the... I had a recent conversation when the same-sex debate was happening, and I quickly moved out of public Facebook and had quite an extended conversation where it became really apparent that I needed to not push my barrow. I just needed to hear the concern and the anxiety and the fear of, if we allow people of the same sex to marry, where is this all going to lead us? It was far more valuable to hear that and to maintain our friendship, because it's about supporting one another in whatever it is that we experience. Mm. And if she's feeling fear and anxiety, then that's real. The reality is, though, we do live in a pluralist society, so somehow you've got this tension between paying respect to how someone genuinely feels based on their beliefs with the fact that there's another mob feeling exactly the same way, but in a different place.
And thanks for this morning. It was like confessional. It was great.
Oh, sorry, Tyson. I fully accept that, and I fully accept the fact that you need to hear where people are coming from. What I still struggle with is the fact that it's false equivalence to say that the rights, the grief and loss that a group of formerly privileged or currently privileged people is the same as, the masses of people around the world who have been oppressed and, their lives are just so made so hard, and it is false equivalence to say that those two things are
and
equal.
In no way was I suggesting...
No, I know that.
It's been a failed strategy to use the name-calling. If those people still are out there voting with One Nation with those views, we have to have the relationships with them to have the conversations.
Yeah. Fully accept.
But still call out the view.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right, they're not the same.
Thanks for listening. Yeah. Thanks, Paul. Paul, I'll have a beer with you anytime. I always really appreciate the opportunity to hear the multi-layered weavings of your mind and the way that you, yeah, that you think about things and then you integrate them. That's honestly really, really rich for me. I think that was great, and I think there was a fair amount of courage in some of the things that you were saying. And I just wanted to say, with some of the kind of confession-y type things, I reckon there's a good number of people in this room that will be like, oh yeah, that's me as well. But more than that, there might be a few people who today or during the week might kind of think, maybe I am doing that too. And that makes those kinds of statements to say out loud really powerful to all of us. Yeah? So that's a really big thank you. Do you want to say it, Paul?
Not just for Paul, but for all of us.
I haven't had a chance for, so I'm really sorry, Scott, to send him this talk. I was going to send him a draft, but it just took too long to write. But from us, thank you, Scott, for, even if you didn't want this talk to happen. I'm sorry, it's too late now. But bless you, brother.